So we're finishing tonight this exploration of the Bodhisattva precepts, the 16 Bodhisattva precepts of the Soto Zen tradition. Bodhisattva precepts, the ways of conduct for a bodhisattva, for a being who's dedicated to living for the benefit of all beings, for their own and others' happiness, for the freedom and joy that is the bodhisattva way. Our ancestors and the Buddha have given us this path of these ways to live that are a great gift to us. So the last of these Bodhisattva precepts, and if you haven't been around for all these previous weeks to hear the other ones, this is of course the most important. And it's the completion and summary of the list. So it includes all the others. So you need not worry about having missed other ones. This last practice precept is called not disparaging the three treasures, or not slandering the three treasures. I think we could translate it either way. It seems like looking at these English words in the dictionary that slander means to like falsely accuse, as I understand it, to kind of ruins someone's or something's reputation by spreading false stories about them. It has this element of falsehood, slander, to slander someone. Whereas disparaging doesn't necessarily mean you're saying false things, it's just like saying nasty things. So disparagement would include slander, it seems to me, but slander doesn't necessarily include disparagement. So to be more complete, we could say not disparaging the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in the commentary from the source sutra for these precepts, the Brahmajala Sutra, it says, a bodhisattva, even hearing somebody else slandering the three treasures or disparaging Buddha, feels like 300 spears stuck into their heart. And then the sutra says, so how much the more so would a bodhisattva refrain from disparaging the three treasures oneself? It's so painful just to even hear someone else. So that's kind of an extreme statement, but a provocative one, I think, to contemplate why a bodhisattva would feel such pain when the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are criticized. There's also this danger there in this kind of talk. When I heard that, I felt a danger in sectarianism, this kind of thing, right? Would they feel that pain if some other spiritual tradition were disparaged? Maybe not. But I think the way to avoid sectarianism in these kinds of discussions is to explore deeply what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha mean. Because even though they're terms in the Buddhist tradition, they go way beyond the Buddhist tradition. They're just Buddha's language for universal principles, you could say. And we talked about them back at the beginning of this series of speaking of Bodhisattva precepts, because the first three of the 16 are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So now we've come full circle closing the circle with, again, just not criticizing, not disparaging these same three treasures we've taken refuge in. With all the other bodhisattva precepts held carefully in between the refuge and the not disparaging these three. So one way to approach what they are in the most universal kind of way is to look at Dogen Zenji's comments on the precepts. So his short, pithy commentary that is often hard to fathom says something like, the body is manifested, the Dharma is enacted, and there is a bridge in the world for crossing over. So it could also be translated as manifest the body, enact the Dharma, and you know, there is a bridge, or even we could maybe stretch it and say make a bridge in the world for crossing over, if we're taking it as a personal instruction. So the body, in this case, is Buddha. The body is manifested. The Buddha body is manifested. In the great vehicle tradition of Buddhism, there's three Buddha bodies. There's the Dharma body, or the truth body, reality body, and the Dharmakaya. And it's just the formless expanse of ungraspability itself, suchness, the way things are, which is that they aren't, the inconceivable way of being that is free from all distress and suffering and difficulty. The Dharmakaya. And there's the Nirmanakaya, the manifestation body. So the body is manifested in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha as Nirmanakaya, a manifestation body, the historical Buddha, any other Buddhas who've appeared in human form, and we can even expand that to be that actually Buddha is manifesting all the time as everything, actually, is manifestation of Buddha in the greatest, largest sense of manifestation. If Buddha Dharmakaya is suchness, well, suchness is manifesting every possible place. There's no place it doesn't manifest. And the third Buddha body, Sambhogakaya, the bliss body, is maybe we could say when a human being touches this suchness or Dharmakaya, the resultant bliss and effect of that human contact with the ultimate is this bliss body, and in its traditional presentation, it can only be seen by other bodhisattvas. This Sambhogakaya, like Amitabha Buddha, you might have heard of in the Pure Land, for example, this is like a Sambhogakaya Buddha. Not quite a Nirmanakaya, not quite a human living in the world as we usually see it, and yet a named and sometimes appearing Buddha with a particular Pure Land, with a particular name. The body is manifested in every possible place as the Dharma body. The Dharma is enacted. If the Buddha is an inconceivable way, everything is beyond all our ideas of it. The Dharma is a way to open to such a reality. And one way, one teaching that the Buddha offers to open to the reality beyond all our ideas of it, a complete ungraspability, is the way that everything is interdependent. Everything is dependent on everything else. And particularly, the world as we see it and know it is dependent on this mind. The way we're experiencing this event right now, this Zendo and these words and this particular time and place, is dependent on our particular unique perceptual apparatus called mind and the sensory receptors. So each one of us is experiencing this event completely differently right now, according to Dharma. So some people might be... I've never really heard teaching in the Buddhist tradition before, and this might sound really, really weird and like almost nonsense. And some people might have heard this kind of thing before and be kind of bored because you just, you know, oh yeah, this again. And some people might not even be listening at all, but just enjoying the fading light in the room and hearing some strange words here and there between their thoughts and all kinds of other experiences. I have no idea. But that there's not a fixed Zendo outside of our own, each of our unique experience. So the Zendo is dependent on our mind. And so this is one, I think, most profound, I would say, meaning of interdependence. That everything is dependent on mind. That's a teaching, a Dharma teaching. And that's a way to approach this proposition that actually everything is not the way we think it is. Even the way we think that it's dependent on the mind. We have some idea hearing that maybe that, oh yeah, actually I can see everything is not just some fixed way, it is different for me and for somebody else, the way we're perceiving and feeling each situation. But even the way we hear that teaching is somewhat limited. So the Buddha is like the way that even the way we understand that teaching doesn't reach what actually is. But hearing such a teaching is an approach to Buddha, which is the way that we understand that teaching, not reaching that teaching, or not reaching reality. The body is manifested inconceivably. The Dharma is enacted by hearing and speaking and living such teachings. And the Sangha, Dogen's commentary says, there's a bridge in the world for crossing over. This is Sangha, the Sangha treasure. Sangha at it, again, it's at its most universal level, So you could see the universal level of Buddha being the inconceivability of everything beyond our ideas. That's not limited to what we call Buddhism by any means, right? Buddha had a certain way of talking about that teaching, but all spiritual teachings share this aspect of the vast, inconceivable source and its manifestation everywhere. I think all traditions across the world would say this vast inconceivability is manifesting in the song of the bird and the hum of the tires on the road and the changing light in the zendo. And all traditions, I would say, probably would agree that that opening to such an inconceivability has something to do with understanding how this unique person works and how our mind and heart work. And Sangha, in the most universal sense, is like the community of beings who want to enact the Dharma and manifest the Buddha body. So it's not necessarily the Sangha, not necessarily the community of Buddhist practitioners in its largest sense. It's the community of all those who are on the spiritual path. And we might think that that sounds kind of limited. Well, what about ones who aren't on the spiritual path? But I think looking deeper, we see that actually isn't everyone on a path in one way or another, whether they recognize it as such or not. The body is manifested, the Dharma is enacted, and there is a bridge in the world for crossing over. The Sangha, the community, is the bridge in the world for crossing over to the other shore, for crossing over from the shore of suffering and discontent to the shore of freedom and the inconceivable Buddha mind. And if we take it as a practice instruction, we could say, manifest the body, enact the Dharma, and be a bridge in the world for crossing over, for crossing others over. That's what a bridge does. It just stretches out from one shore to the other in a big arc and stays there so others can walk across its back. A bridge isn't there for itself, right? It's only there for other people to walk across, often without even noticing that they're on a bridge, you know. It's so easy to take bridges for granted, which is a nice thing about bodhisattvas. They can be almost unnoticeable as they let people cross over, help people cross over. And then Dogen says, the virtue of the three treasures returns to the ocean of all knowing wisdom. Which again is another word for Buddha, all knowing wisdom. Omniscience, sometimes translated. Completely omniscience means, you know, like knowing everything, all knowing wisdom. But it doesn't mean like knowing that there's a little ant under the platform here walking around. Buddhas might sometimes be able to do that, but that's not so important. It's more they know everything because everything is inconceivable and beyond the way that conceptual thinking can grasp it. So they can instantly know everything completely in such a way. So not disparaging the three treasures is not to criticize or look down upon such a strange and vast and maybe even frustrating teaching. Another word for disparage is depreciate. The dictionary lists as a synonym. So depreciate seems to be the opposite of appreciate. So even to not appreciate the way everything is beyond the way we think it is, and not appreciate the way everything is dependent on this mind to arise in the way that we're experiencing it, and not appreciate those who are practicing together to try to realize such a truth. And appreciating is the same as taking refuge in. Taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is not disparaging Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And taking refuge means going to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as the place of security. A refuge is a place of security and safety. And though it might take some reflection to understand how Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha like this could be a place of supreme security, it seems like the place of supreme insecurity, maybe hearing about it at first. Ungraspability and inconceivability doesn't seem very secure, and yet it's ultimately the only true security. Everything graspable and knowable is actually not very secure. It's all impermanent and quickly passing. So for true safety and security is only possible in this realm of suchness beyond all our ideas. And so ultimately the three treasures can't really be disparaged, because how could inconceivability be, how could anything be done to it? So, and again, these three levels of precepts, of a literal level, a compassionate level, and a ultimate level. In the ultimate level, they can't be disparaged. There is no disparaging the triple treasure. The triple treasure is beyond that possibility. And to realize that helps us to, on a literal level, not disparage. So on a more down to earth, maybe, level of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We could also say Buddha is like the mind of Zazen. When we sit down in Zazen and sit upright and breathe deeply and relax into the moment and with the deep intention to release past thinking and future thinking, and open to the freshness of this moment beyond our chattering mind, even while our chattering mind might be chattering away, to open to this deeper peace that's underlying each moment, even when we're caught up in things, and to taste that a little bit more deeply by actually sitting really still, upright, and silent for a while, and relaxing into that. That's a possibility of Buddha that's available any moment. And Dharma is any teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors, and even other spiritual traditions. You could say any teaching that's helpful, that helps set people free from their grasping mind. And Sangha is the community of friends and practitioners practicing the way together, all of us here in this room. Or another way that I think I've mentioned before, my teachers sometimes define Sangha is whoever encourages us to practice. So it might be someone who's never heard of Buddhism. Whoever, and we could even say whatever, if we see maybe an animal or something, maybe our cat, the way it, it just curls up and rests by the fire, something like that, might encourage us to practice. At that moment, it becomes Sangha. Later, if it doesn't encourage us anymore, you could say it's maybe temporarily not functioning as Sangha that way. But we can kind of, in some sense, choose how big or small to make our Sangha by just opening to, feeling the encouragement and support of more and more people and things. How nice, right? We can have a huge, huge Sangha, momentarily maybe even, right? And like the next moment it can go from like a billion beings Sangha to like one or two. And then we can expand it again. And finding refuge there, finding security and peace and safety where we can't. Security and safety means like a place where we can't be harmed in any possible way. And so you might be able to see how in this vast space that's beyond all our notions of this life and death, even death as the ultimate threat to our life, doesn't disturb the security of Buddha, in that sense of Buddha. Would anyone like to bring anything up?
Kokyo, I want to confess that I haven't really looked very closely at this last precept, not disparaging the three treasures. The others, for instance, I work with anger several times in a day. I work with deciding what's true or not. You know, am I stretching the truth for my own purposes or not?
Mm-hmm.
Several times a day. I have sexual thoughts several times a day. The others, mm-hmm. it seems I've got a predisposition to balance, weigh, work with, mm-hmm. Killing. You know, do I eat this? Do I not eat this?
Yeah.
This one
seems different.
Seems different.
Mm-hmm.
What's it doing there?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard lectures such as yours the generalizability of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha into other realms, like your example of the cat being our temporary sangha.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it seems like it's so different than the others that have a little bit more fire to it.
And we seem more specific, maybe.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like wrapping it up at the end. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, so Banjin Dotan, who comments on Dogen's comments, says something like, even if we don't follow the other nine major bodhisattva precepts completely, if we have faith in the three treasures and don't disparage the three treasures, everything is complete. Which I thought, that's a quite a statement too. It's almost saying it's like the most important. And we could say also to put Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as the first three makes them the kind of overall support for the rest. So, but it's true that it doesn't seem as specific. Maybe it's just reminding us at the end of the list that it's, that the, the overall context of Buddha, that all this is, it's pointing back, all these precepts are pointing back towards Buddha in mind. And, though they have very practical, straightforward applications, they work on so many different levels, and they go so so deep as well as shallow. So that's part of it.
I guess too, it's the term disparage.
Mm.
I mean, I could imagine kind of a summation of practice, with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But is there a practical equivalent to disparaging three treasures? I mean, are there people who go around waving their fingers at the Zen center when they see it? That's blasphemy. Was there a time when religions were so polar that there were people that cursed the monks? It's just the whole disparage.
Yeah.
I'm not tempted to disparage any religion very much.
Well, maybe there were those times, and also these are bodhisattva precepts, so I think it says in the Brahmajala Sutra text on the precept, it says not slandering the collection of bodhisattva teachings. So this could go back to the time of the transition to Mahayana, and when there were other more orthodox schools like Theravada happening, and that because still now, like in present day Theravada tradition, maybe they wouldn't call it disparage, but they don't count the Mahayana sutras as sutras. They're like, well, they're nice literature maybe, but they're not Buddha's teaching. I mean, I've heard Theravada teachers say that, some anyway. And so, in a way, that could be they're maybe making this point about. And actually, in the Brahmajala Sutra and the minor precepts too, there's a lot of talk about not falling back into mere smaller vehicle teachings out of fear of the Mahayana. Often it's kind of like, or out of the ungraspable aspect of the Mahayana, like, well, let's get, like, we want some straightforward stuff here, you know, and the Pali Canon I myself find so beautiful, and the teachings are they're a little more graspable, actually, they're more straightforward, you know, we can get them, and they're helpful and applicable. And so there's these minor bodhisattva precepts that say bodhisattvas should not revert back to simpler teachings just because the Mahayana is so vast and ungraspable and inconceivable and frighteningly amazing. So I think that might be part of it too, particularly disparaging the Mahayana and how it sometimes even sounds contradictory and all kinds of these kind of more ultimate teachings can be frightening to really open to them, and also they sometimes sound contradictory to simpler, lesser vehicle teachings. For example, the compassionate level of the bodhisattva precepts traditionally taught, like sometimes you actually break the literal level of precepts to be a compassionate bodhisattva and benefit beings, whereas maybe what we could call, I'm not saying Theravada here, I'm saying more like the concept of the lesser, of a lesser vehicle that's more like very literal, could say actually that's horrible to say, like, you could break the precepts even to be compassionate. It's better to keep the precepts perfectly than to even be compassionate if you have to make one choice or the other. So that would be another form of, could be slander the Mahayana.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
On the other hand, I mean, correct me if this is overly simplistic, but I've always kind of thought of this as, okay, if Buddha is, you know, this moment, then when I am resisting this moment, to me, I'm disparaging Buddha. I'm not being open to the possibility of awakening. It's like resistance, I think, of almost, you know, if I'm pushing away the possibility of awakening, by the same token, Dharma, the way things are, if I'm resisting the way things are, I've thought of that as disparaging Dharma, and by the same token, Sangha, you know, turning away from others, being afraid of people, closing down to people, as disparaging, again, seeing, you know, the possibility. So that seems to work for me. That feels very practical. But what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, it reminds me of this part of the commentary that says, this is a little different, but in the same vein, clearly understanding the three treasures is called taking refuge in the three treasures. And we could say clearly understanding might be like opening to clear awareness and receptivity is, in practice, is a lot like understanding. And being ignorant of the three treasures is called disparaging the three treasures. And we could also say it, being ignorant is kind of like I don't want to look at it, or is a kind of a form of resistance, actually. So I think so. Yeah. So all these different levels.
I really appreciate what you said about each. You know, the very practical ways that we can bump into, I don't want to run like this, or in terms of our own just sitting by ourselves or being with others. What came up for me was the beauty of that image of the bridge for Sangha. And I just became aware again that I sing in a choir, every Monday night. And one of the songs that we're currently practicing for our concert in June is Like a Bridge Over Troubled Water. I Will Lay Me Down.
There it is, yeah.
And there it is. And I don't know where that old, I can't remember the source of that old song, but it's been around.
Simon and Garfunkel.
I knew you'd know.
Right, way back in 1968.
Right. Okay, so Like a Bridge Over Troubled
Water. It's a Bible passage.
Oh, really?
I think it comes out of the Bible too. I think that's where the actual, you know, pull is. I keep meaning to, you know, Google and find it somehow. But that for me, that's the these are the kinds of reminders that cross over, you know, so that the Sangha is really huge, and unfathomable.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up that image. That's a great, very, just exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So, and upon not resisting the three treasures, we the other nine bodhisattva precepts are kept. It seems, you know, right? Isn't it a form if we're intending to or enacting killing or stealing or whatever? It's isn't that because we're actually resisting the reality of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? So it's like. So that is a reason why Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha refuge is comes first, and then it takes these 10 forms, and why it's just reminded again at the end. Yeah, so that was the one of the Buddha's first teachings was refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the fact that I think the Buddha didn't even really come up with it, it's more like people heard the Buddha or saw the Buddha, heard a little bit, and then said, I want to take refuge in you, meaning like your mind, Buddha's mind, and your teaching that's helped me so much. And the first people, there wasn't really a Sangha that they were aware of yet. And when there were a few more people who had taken refuge in Buddha's mind that they knew of, then they could also take refuge in Sangha. Yeah.
I was recalling your imagery of a cat curled up by a fire and how that could encourage practice, but it seems in my experience what encourages practice is when it becomes a little gritty, a little difficult situation, and that we can extend the sangha to those that make it really difficult, and then it's more of expanding to that situation instead of closing in, and that in itself is also sangha, not just the serene or pleasant images that encourage, but also those really dark, ugly images encourage as well.
Totally, yeah. And maybe more so, really, in the end, is the difficulties are where we grow. And they show us where we're holding on. So I think I've mentioned before here that sometimes I start to get worried if not having enough difficulty, because I feel like things that start to get, you know, nothing's happening. It's very nice, but where is the, what's the next thing to let go of? What's the edge? So, yeah, to be grateful for difficulties because they actually encourage us to practice, or we could say take deeper refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So thank you so much for being here for this exploration of Bodhisattva precepts that started last year, I think, at some point. And I think great to periodically go through this because it's such a source of our practice and a manifestation of our practice. And we can start something completely new now. Now for something completely different. May all beings open to the three treasures and the Bodhisattva precepts and the great joy that comes through living such a life.